This is 4:55 on Wednesday, October 26th. I think things are ready. So, we move on to chapter 5. We will talk about this for the next 2 weeks, approximately, and then the exam will be the first full week in November. Right. So, once again, the approach taken with this book, and I think it's a pretty good one, is to understand the principles of each layer, sort of overriding, and then to or overarching, and then to look at specific issues as they may relate in real technologies that you may encounter. And the approach, again, is one of asking what are the services provided by the layer to the layers above it, and then we'll talk about the details. So, what are the services? The idea is that the link layer is transferring datagrams between adjacent nodes. And this idea of having a layer with this responsibility goes back to the OSI model that we talked about before, and the internet model as well, the layered models. And the cool thing about it is, once people sort of got in their heads that the link layer was separate from the network layer, it became possible to build different kinds of networks into these internets. Right? That was sort of a breakthrough that said I could have a network that spanned all different kinds of link layers. And it's still the case that in the research that I do, working with electric power engineers, they don't sort of get this as a overriding or sort of master principle of networking. If you don't have that perspective, what you tend to do is say, well, I've got this neat technology for linking nodes together. How do I build a network out of it? Using that technology, right? And you lose all the benefits of all the other technologies that are available for doing link layers as part of your network. So that's one of the things I noticed, and I think this is a really important observation about networking, is that what goes on in the link layer is related to the network layer, but it doesn't govern the network layer. Terminology, I guess we're calling the things that go over the data links frames. We called the things at the network layer, we called them packets, and at the transport layer, we called them segments. Okay, and they're all very closely related. You're stuffing one inside the other as you go down the stack. Okay, so I guess this is just what I said before. You can mix links in a network, and that's cool. Another thing that we'll see is that the link layer protocols have slightly different service models. So, for example, some link layers provide reliable data transport. You send a packet over the link layer, and the adjacent node says, yes, I got it, or no, I didn't. Other link layers don't do that. We'll talk about why. Okay, well, the sort of basic service is that you have to take a datagram or a packet and stick it into a frame by adding bits before and after if necessary. If you have a link that is shared among multiple hosts, the link layer is the part that's responsible for negotiating who can send when. All right, that's taken care of there. And addressing is another issue in the link layer, because each link layer gets defined, as I said, independent of the network. So the network addresses don't necessarily correspond in an obvious way to the link layer addresses. So that's where this idea of a MAC address comes from. Media Access Control is what MAC stands for. Link layer addresses, all right, and we'll talk about those and how you get back and forth between network layer addresses and link layer addresses. And reliable delivery may be a part of the model. We talked about how to do that as part of the transport layer, right? That's something that TCP does. So why would you use it on a link layer? Why would you use it on link layer? So suppose you have a fairly lossy link. That is, you tend to, when you send packets into it, they don't show up very reliably at the other side. Modest probability of that happening, a percent or more, say. Compare that with the links that are used, the wired links that we typically think of in the internet that have packet loss rates in the 0.1% or 0.001% level. Now we're in excess of a percent. So you send a packet, it gets lost. That means it doesn't ever reach its ultimate destination. Okay. What does the transport layer RDT infer from that? TCP. What does TCP do when it doesn't get a packet? It just sits there. Okay. It sits there. It essentially does nothing in response to a packet it didn't get, because it didn't get it, of course. And when it gets subsequent packets, it continues to send the acknowledgement for the last packet that it got without a gap. And what happens then? Well, either the sender times out, or if it keeps getting acknowledgements, what happens? Remember that one? You do. Tell me about it.
If it keeps on getting acknowledgements for the same packet, that means one of the previous packets was lost. So.
Right. So it triggers what mechanism?
The word that I'm trying to say. Yes. Triggers that.
That one. Fast retransmit. Yeah. Yes. Right. Fast retransmit. But how long does it take to trigger that fast retransmit, and how long does it take to replace the missing packet? It takes essentially a full round trip time, at least more than a full round trip time, to replace the missing packet. Well, if this unreliable link is in the middle of something that has a long round trip time, then what we're doing is we're suffering sort of round trip times to replace packets. That's one thing that happens. What's the other thing that missing packets causes TCP to do?
Congestion
control, right? Exactly. And missing packets due to sort of bad channels are not necessarily congestion. right? The right response to sending a packet over a lossy channel where the losses are not due to congestion is to aggressively try to send it, right? Whereas TCP's behavior is to get less and less aggressive about sending it. So that those are some of the reasons why you might want to put a RDT mechanism into a link layer, because you can fix the problem quickly just at between the pair of adjacent hosts without waiting to involve everybody else in the process, and because you may be signaling congestion where congestion isn't really the problem. Okay, so wireless links, satellite links, and so forth may want to use RDT mechanisms at the link layer. Okay, so they're the same kind of mechanism that we talked about for the transport layer, but it's just implemented at the link layer. Okay. You may need to do flow control between adjacent sending and receiving nodes. Remember, we have flow control in the transport layer, at least with TCP. But again, that doesn't deal with the the ups and downs going on between adjacent nodes. And it sort of depends on what else is happening, for example, in the routers, whether flow control is really an issue or not. Okay. Error detection. We're going to talk about error detection here in a second. Error correction. So again, if you have a channel or link that is suffering errors, corruption of frames, you'd like to either fix them or get them out of the system as quickly as possible, right? If you can fix them, that's great, because then you haven't wasted the time for sending the frame. You're able to repair it and send it onward. But if you can't fix it, then getting it out of the system keeps it from occupying additional resources downstream. So this is pretty typically part of a link layer. And another, I don't know if this is a service or not, but another concept that goes along with link layers is whether both ends are able to send simultaneously or not. And that when they can, that's called full duplex. And when the ends have to take turns, that's called half duplex. And if the data transfer is really only in one direction, that's called simplex. And simplex is not usually part of the way that networks are built these days. That was a much older scheme where you might have somebody typing on a teletypewriter, sending out to printers all over the place. The printers had no way to communicate back to the teletypewriter. It was a kind of simplex communication. But half duplex and full duplex are what you find. The TCP model really is conceptually full duplex, right? You have a sender and a receiver. You have a sender and a receiver going one direction. You have a sender and a receiver going the other direction. How it gets implemented underneath, TCP doesn't care about, but at least conceptually, it's full duplex communication. How does it get implemented? We don't have the little artifacts to pass around anymore. Once upon a time, wireless was implemented on a card that you plugged into your laptop computer, and I could pass around the cards. Once upon a time, Ethernet was implemented on cards that were plugged into the buses on the desktop machines. Not anymore. They're built into the motherboards these days, almost always. So, but anyway, at least somewhere there is a set of integrated circuits that build up the network interface for each different kind of link layer. And of course you have a different set of integrated circuits for the different kinds of link layers. And the interface devices, I'll call them, typically implement both the physical and the link layer aspects of the actual point-to-point link. The physical layer is either transistors that drive voltages or charges onto wires, or that light up or darken LED lights, LED laser lights, usually, for sending and then for receiving. Similarly, transistors or phototransistors for interpreting the voltages or currents or photons on the links that attach things when they're not broadcast, or radio receivers when they are. Okay, so fairly obviously, I think, you have the datagram or packet. You stick it inside some more bits. These are the bits of the datagram, more bits in the form of a header and a trailer that implement all of the additional services of the link layer. But this is the encapsulation idea that we've been talking about all along, and it's just what do you encapsulate it with is the only question. Okay, let's talk about error detection correction. Here's the basic theory of it. You have a datagram, or a frame or something, it doesn't sort of matter what it is. You have some data that you want to protect. And the way you protect data is by adding more data that says something about the data that you already have. That's called redundancy. Right? So they've called those here the error detecting and correcting bits. So it takes more bits to protect something than the bits that you started with. You have to add something to it. And the idea is that there's some computation that relates what's in here to what's in here. You send this over the link, and things should be designed so that if you get back something here where you run the same computation on this to get this, when you run the computation on this, you should get this, assuming that all has happened correctly, right? That there's been no error. And if they're not, then it's a bad datagram and you throw it on the ground, and otherwise you deliver it. Can somebody give me an argument why with fewer bits here than here, you can't detect all errors? So in principle.
Because there's multiple ways to get the EDC. There are multiple Ds that can make a single EDC.
Exactly. There have to be multiple D. If there are fewer bits here than there are here, then there have to be multiple values of D that map onto the same value of EDC. Okay? So you can't tell the difference between the original D and one of the other ones that maps onto the same EDC. Okay? How about, just for grins, how about suppose I let the EDC be as big as the original D? Can I detect all errors then?
No, because the EDC itself can be corrupted.
Right. There could be there could be sort of compatible corruptions between the two. There's just no way to overcome that.
Yeah. Where does the correction come into play? Because we've got error detection, but we're just throwing out packets. Is there any way to correct the E from?
Right. So this is a bit of a lie, right? If you have a correction code here, you may be able to fix D prime back into D and let it go on up. Okay. We're not going to talk too much about those. Although here's a simple one. So the most basic kind of error checking code is the parity bit. And the idea here is that you say that you make up a rule that your rule is, for example, that the combined message of the data bits together with the parity bit must have an even number of 1 bits in it. Okay? And you can easily achieve that for any message that you might want to send, right? Because if it has an odd number of 1 bits in it, you set this bit to 1, and if it has an even number, you set it to 0. So it's well defined how to set that parity bit. And when you get the message at the other end, you just check the parity bit, and you can tell, you can identify that some kinds of errors have occurred. But there are many kinds of errors that you can't detect with just a parity bit. For example, if 2 bits have been flipped in the message, or the message plus the parity bit, then you won't detect that, right? So it's a pretty weak kind of checking. It can detect single-bit errors. A two-dimensional parity scheme can actually detect and correct single-bit errors. And it can detect some double-bit errors. So the example here shows a bit that is flipped from here to here, and you see that you get a parity error in a particular row and a parity error in a column, and that the intersection of the two identifies the place that the error occurred. Again, it's pretty weak. It can't deal with double bit errors, and it can't correct. There are double bit errors that it can't even detect. And is that true? Maybe not. Can you detect all double bit errors with this one?
If there's 2 of them switched in the same line, then it won't flag the parity.
It won't flag the parity, but it will flag the parity in both columns in that case.
But then you won't be able to see the position.
You can't correct it, yeah. But the question was, could you detect it?
Yeah.
All right. If they're in different rows, I guess it can detect. Okay, so it can detect double bit errors. But presumably, if we go to 3, we can construct examples where it can't. Okay, the internet checksum, the checksum that's used in the UDP packets and for the IP header checksum, is a very simple thing that just does addition of the 16-bit quantities that make up the words. There's a few tricks about using 1's complement instead of 2's complement and so on and so forth, but it's a, again, a very weak kind of checksum. But it's easy and fast to compute. This is the main advantage that it has, but notice that, that when IP version 6 came along, they decided it wasn't good enough to keep. Right? They threw it out of IP version 6. At least at the IP layer. So it's not super good. Notice that it's a 16-bit checksum over what may be up to 64K bytes of data, which means that there are a whole lot of different errors that could map onto the same checksum because you're taking 2 to the 64K bytes. 64K bytes is 512K bits. So you're taking 2 to the 512 different values and mapping them down to 2 to the 16th different values. That's a, you know, that's a lot of collisions. So not great. All right. So the more powerful checksums are often in this form called cyclic redundancy checks. And I'm going to explain this a little bit differently than what it does on the slides because I think they don't do it right. Not completely right, for understanding anyway. So the cool thing about these cyclic redundancy checks is that we're going to describe them as being implemented as a division. A kind of division, a special kind of division. But in fact, they can be implemented with what are called feedback shift registers, which can be hardware devices. That you feed a value into. You feed in the value this way, and you take the output from here, and you XOR the output bit back into the input bits in a kind of clever way. And as a result, these CRCs are sort of really fast to implement because if you have any sort of data path that can process the bits sequentially, and notice that the networks often do process the bits sequentially, right? You're sending the bits one at a time on a wire, so if you can build a circuit like this that goes at the same speed as your wire, which shouldn't be too hard, you can easily implement this CRC check very quickly. Okay, so here's the, I'm going to describe it, however, as division. So we have the data bits. We have a fixed R plus 1 bit pattern called the generator that is fixed for a particular CRC scheme. So, you know, if a link uses a particular CRC scheme, there's just exactly one generator that's used for that. And our goal then is to take our knowledge of D, our knowledge of G, and generate R more bits, an R bit value capital R, such that essentially D concatenated with R, viewed as a single value, is evenly divisible by G. Okay? And divisible in a specialized sense. Okay? So the sender has to use D and G to create R, And the receiver then checks that G is evenly divisible into the set of bits D followed by the set of bits R. Okay? And this CRC scheme is particularly good because the kinds of errors that actually happen on real links tend to be these bursts of bits that get all corrupted, right? Or get some of the bits within the fixed size range gets corrupted. And so you can design these CRC things so that you can catch essentially all of the most common errors on any of these bursty error links. All right, so I'm going to now show you how this works. So here, let me tell you what's wrong with this slide. Sorry. So we don't view them as a binary number. We view them as a binary polynomial. So that means suppose I have this, suppose D is equal to 1011011. What that means is, or our interpretation of that is that it's 1 times x to the 6th plus 0 times x to the 5th plus 1 times x to the 4th plus 1 times x to the 3rd plus 0 times x squared plus x plus 1. Right? So we're treating the bits of the data as these coefficients of a polynomial of appropriate degree. And then this value, and similarly for R, and so what dr means, when I write dr, that's really d times x to the r plus r, rather than times 2 to the r. This 2 is bogus. That's what I'm saying here. All right? Because I'm going to show you polynomial division here in a second, and it works differently from binary division. So dr is really d times x to the r. You take that polynomial and just multiply it by through by x to the r, which adds r to all of the exponents, right? And then you add on whatever r is, again as a polynomial, an r bit polynomial. Right. So why does it matter that I switch from 2 to x and forget that. Let's just pause. Well, what we're saying is d times x to the r plus r to be divisible by g means that it's equal to some constant polynomial times g without a remainder. You can say it that way. So what that says is that we need to have a situation where we divide in the polynomial sense the combination of d concatenated with r by g and have it come out even. And how do we do that? All right. So now, It's probably been a long time since you've done polynomial division. Have you ever done polynomial division? In algebra, right? This was high school algebra, 8th grade, Math 107. Probably did not do much of it in calculus, is my guess. No. All right, so it's been a long time. So let's remember how polynomial division works. Suppose I want to divide What's happening? How easy this is? What? It is not complicated math. The only numbers you have to deal with are 1 and 0. Okay? And you don't even have to do any borrowing.
I don't know if I can do that.
Okay? this is the beauty of the polynomial version of this instead of the binary version is there's no borrowing involved because the different exponents don't interact. So polynomial division, x squared plus 1 into x to the 4th plus x cubed plus 1. Well, let's do 0 times x squared plus 1. And the other thing is we're only doing binary coefficients. Right, so they're either 1 or 0, and let's see how that goes. So x squared plus 1 into x to the 4th to x cubed, so you write that's x to the 1st, and then that's, x squared. Yes, you would do x squared. So you write that's x to the 4th. Plus x squared, and then you do XOR operations between the coefficients, and so 1 XOR 1 is 0, 1 XOR 0 is 1, and 1. All right. So then you do x squared plus 1 into that is x, right? And then you get x times x is x cubed, and x times 1 is x. So I don't know if this is going to go evenly or not. So then we have 1 x squared plus x plus 1, I guess, right? Etc. No, it's not going to go evenly, because then we go x squared, and that takes care of the 1, and we're left with an x left over. All right. Okay, so just polynomial division, binary coefficients, the operation for combining the binary coefficients is XOR. All right. So let's do, I'll erase that mess, and look how it goes for the example on the slide. We don't have to write down the x's, right, because they just correspond to different positions on our diagram. So you need that much in order to, you need to sort of match up the length, and if the first digit here is 1, then the first digit here is 1, then the quotient digit is 1. So this is the quotient that we're developing up here. So you take this times this to get this. Right? And then you do the XOR operation between the digits. And 1, 0 is 1, and 1, 1 is 0, and break down the next one. And it's not long enough. It's only 3 digits long, so you can't divide that. So the next quotient digit is 0, and you multiply those, and you get 0, and then you do the XOR operation one more time, and how'd that happen? It's a fixed size font, so why does it... Oh, yeah. All right. So you bring down the 0. Okay. So now you have a 4-digit divisor and a 4-digit dividend. And so that goes 1 because they both have 1 there. And so 1 times that is 1001. Do the subtraction. You get 0's there, 1's there. Bring down another 0. It's not enough. So there's our next 0 of the quotient, and so on, and so forth, and so on, and so forth. And eventually you get to the point where you're all done. You come to the end of the dividend, and what's left over is the remainder. Oh, the important thing is that it's these bits, not over 1001. Okay, so what we're going to do with this then is we're going to stick... Notice that this was our original data. Our computation started by putting zeros here and doing the division. What we're going to do now is we're going to stick those digits in as the actual message to be sent. So our message to be sent will be 101110. That's D. And this R gets stuck in here, 011. That's R. And the claim is that if you now divide this by this, you'll end up with a remainder of 0. Yeah.
Why did they choose to do division? Division's like the simplest possible form of
conflict. Well, it is if you have borrowing, but as I observed, this division process can be done by one of these feedback shift registers that runs at essentially the full speed of the line. This particular kind of division, right, where the only thing that we're doing is essentially multiplying 1 and 0 and subtracting. You're either multiplying 1 times 1 or 1 times 0, and you're either XORing 1 and 1, 1 and 0, or 0 and 0. That's all that you're ever doing here. Those are the complete set of primitive operations that are happening, and then you're shifting your attention through here as you go, and that's what a feedback shift register does. Okay, so this is the general scheme of the CRCs, polynomial division. And by saying polynomial division, what we're saying is that there's no carrying or borrowing involved, right? Because when you multiply and divide polynomials, the different exponent, the terms with the different exponents don't ever interact in the adding and subtracting steps, right? They just get carried along each time. Okay, so it's worth knowing about that. I mean, I typically put a little problem like this on the exams because I want you to know how this works, how this polynomial division works, and how to do it. So be warned. All right. Well, from there, that's sort of lowest level thing. The next thing to talk about is how to deal with the fact that we may have multiple transmitters trying to send on a given link at a given time, right? And this crops up with old-fashioned original Ethernet. It crops up with certainly with radio schemes. It crops up with certain other kinds of sort of bus-like communications. And there are different ways of dealing with it. Some of them are very fixed in how they work. You can, and we'll talk about this more next time, but just as a preview, you can think of all kinds of different ways to share the right to access a particular bit of wire, say. So what ways can you think of? Right? I have a bunch of people who all want to send on the same wire. We know that if several of us send at the same time, it's not going to work. So what do? Get in line. Well, the problem with get in line is that we're all spread all over the place, and there isn't any place to really form a line. Aha! So that's one possibility is that I can signal low and she can signal high, and you know, if we do that, then listeners will be able to understand what both of us are saying. And this is how opera works, right? Can't usually understand opera anyway, but but that's the idea, right? We have people singing on different pitches and sending light of different colors, or sending radio frequencies of different, right? Our radio frequency spectrum works this way all the time. People are sending on different channels and everybody can hear. So that's one way. What's another way? Time multiplexing. We can have some scheme for taking turns that says I send in the first microsecond, and you send in the second microsecond, and you know, the other 998,998 send in different microseconds, right? So that's a possibility. What else? That comes with problems. All of these have problems, right? They don't. None of them is perfect. And another one is, well, we can do like ham radio, right? Where you just start talking, and if if anybody can hear you, that's great. You're supposed to listen before you talk, which is a good idea. And maybe they can understand you, and maybe they can't. And if they can't, they tell you to try again. Essentially, well, this is the essential idea behind Ethernet, and we'll talk about how to actually make some good rules for that, so that you minimize the amount of time wasted on periods when nobody can understand what's going on. Right? So those are the three main ideas. About how this works, and we'll sort of talk about that more next time. Okay?
Can you mix time multiplexing and frequency multiplexing?
Absolutely. Essentially, when you're doing frequency multiplexing, you're carving up your channel into multiple channels, and then you're free to do whatever you want to do on the different sub-pieces. Yeah. You don't have to use the same time slots or anything. Yeah. Separate channels. Okay, well, that's it for today, and on Friday we'll talk more about this.